Paul and Philip Collins are authors and researchers with extensive backgrounds in history, religion, political science, and philosophy. They have authored books such as The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship and The Hidden Face of Terrorism from Antiquity to September 11th. Their articles can be read online at conspiracyarchive.com, and their books can be purchased at major online retailers like Amazon.com. Philip and Paul, thank you for joining me on the Corbett Report today.
Thank you. Thank you so much, James.
No problem. Let's start by learning a little bit about yourselves. What can you tell us about your backgrounds and how you started to get into this line of research?
Well, my background, this is Paul, began in my late teens when we were living in Colorado. That particular state really rubbed off on us. At that time, which was the early 90s, Colorado was made up of people who were rugged individualists with a real healthy suspicion of government. However, they were also real salt-of-the-earth people who would give you the shirt off their backs. So the whole anti-authoritarian environment really rubbed off on us. It was everywhere, including school. While we were in high school, we graduated in 1993, but there was a sizable anarchist crowd that was part of the school population, and cliques were really frowned upon at our school, and everyone was pretty close. Your particular walk of life, notwithstanding. So we were close to a lot of those anarchist kids, and we really didn't share all their views on how society should be arranged, but they did point out some very legitimate flaws with modern government. Clinton was president at the time, and they didn't cut him any slack. Everyone at the time had a sense that something was not quite right, and that included myself. So I got some books, and I began to read. But my epiphany really didn't come until we relocated to Ohio in 1995. At that time, I began taking classes at a local community college. I had started college in Colorado, but I began to get serious about earning a degree when I relocated. And it was at that community college that I met a judge who taught constitutional law and criminal justice as a day job, and then ran his court at night. He was contributing his time to teaching at the college when he wasn't running his course. And so I'd heard that he had had an interesting background, but I didn't know just how interesting until I heard him give a talk in a different class entitled American Issues. He stated that he had been a CIA asset during his college days. He was also reenlisted by the agency when he was in the Marine Corps over in Vietnam. And basically, it was while he was there that the agency wanted him to gather intel from the indigenous population. His legend, and a legend is basically trade wrap for the cover that you have that's supposed to hold until you slip away, was that he was a Canadian national running a trading post and doing trade with the natives. And when he asked what his job would involve, they told him, "Well, you're a nice guy, talk to people," and that is what he did. VC and MVA would warm up to him, tell him what hill their uncles, cousins, brothers, fellow soldiers, etc. were on, and my teacher would report back to his handlers, and lo and behold, the locations he reported ended up being bombed. My teacher ended up making good friends with an MVA general, and the general wanted my teacher to visit Hanoi with him, and he wasn't too thrilled at all with that idea. His agency handlers, however, thought that this was an opportunity to gather intel in the heart of enemy territory, and it was just too good of an opportunity to slip by, so they told him to do it, and he did it, but not too well. I'm sure you can imagine being the only white guy in Hanoi at that time. It was a very stressful time for him, and he just couldn't function right, so he came back with some very poor intel. And someone in the agency wasn't pleased with his performance, and they blew his cover, just to show us that this illustrates that the Valerie Plame affair is nothing new. The intel business is very dangerous, especially when things get politicized. But to make a long story short, he found himself in danger, and if it wasn't for his MVA general friend, he wouldn't be alive today. And this man basically taught me that deep political practices and conspiracy are a reality, so I started to look into it a lot more. But I didn't really start writing about it just yet, because my first real love is acting in the stage. So I was spending most of my time doing plays. And that changed in 2001 when the local theater scene started to dry up and 9/11 happened. And I actually wrote my first book and started to actively engage in this topic seriously at that time.
As for me, this is Philip. Like Paul, my first passion has always been theater, the performing arts, and I had acted in several plays and one independent film. But like Paul said, the theater scene had basically started to dry up here because Ohio is not necessarily the cultural mecca of the United States. I really started to become interested in these particular topics as my studies in media criticism and philosophy progressed. Media criticism, which concerns itself predominantly with semiotics, and semiotics is the study of signs and how signs are used to communicate specific messages. This topic really minces no words about the role of mass media in basically sculpting public opinion, or in the words of Noam Chomsky, manufacturing consent. And during my studies in philosophy, I was introduced to a deceased philosopher, Michel Foucault. And Foucault's work, in particular, Discipline and Punish, basically affirmed the Orwellian contention that society was experiencing a tectonic shift towards a carceral culture. And although some of Foucault's historical research was a little bit questionable, a little bit dubious, it's difficult to trace some of his sources, and some of his material is not sourced at all. And his ideological propensities tended to blur his analysis. Discipline and Punish succinctly demonstrated this mass diffusion of the panoptic schema throughout society, and I found that synchronizing with the assertions of other writers such as George Orwell. In addition to Michel Foucault, I had taken a course called Science and Religion, although it should have been more appropriately dubbed Scientism 101. But essentially, in that course, I was introduced to one particular thinker named Thomas Kuhn, who was one of the thinkers to advance ideas concerning what's come to be known as the sociology of scientific knowledge, which basically holds that scientific paradigms are not formulated within a vacuum. There are sociological considerations to be given to them. And I found that his work and the work of Charles Fort, who also wrote against scientism, really started to dovetail with a lot of these topics. In particular, I was finding with my research, for instance, with Charles Darwin, that he as a thinker and his theories were influenced by several dubious parties, many of which were elitist and technocratic in character. And his theory, of course, became the scientific basis for two of the most predominant technocratic systems of governance of the 20th century, which were communism and fascism. So that basically drew my attention to this field, and as I continued to study, my studies began to dovetail with Paul's studies, and it was at that point that we noticed the coalescence, and we just basically worked it into an overall thesis, and have been working together more or less ever since. And that's essentially our background.
Well, it's a very extensive background, to be sure, and I think that gives my listeners a sense of sort of the scope of your guys' research. I'd like to get into actually one of Darwin's philosophical antecedents in a German philosopher from the 18th century known as Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. I wanted to touch on Hegel's idea of the dialectic. And for those listeners who might be hearing about the dialectic for the first time, could you describe this process and how Hegel believed it operated to bring about historical change?
Sure. Well, essentially, Hegel believed that there was a world spirit, the Weltgeist, if you will. And the Weltgeist was a purely immanent deity. And by immanent, I'm invoking the term immanent from the Latin term in manere, which basically means to remain within. And to remain within what? Within the ontological confines of the physical universe. He believed that this time-bound emergent deity was confined entirely to the ontological plane of the physical universe, and that this deity was basically guiding this process by which opposing forces would continually conflict and through this conflict gradually migrate towards each other and synthesize. Now, Hegel's ideas were in part influenced by a Gnostic Kabbalist known as Christoph Oettinger, and that probably is one of the reasons why his religion was something of an immanent religion, because the Gnostics rejected what was known as cognitio fidei, or that is the cognition of faith, and they wanted to draw the transcendent further into the grip of man, further into the grip of man's senses, and in order to do that, they would, in the words of Eric Voigtman, immanentize transcendent elements. They would basically reconceptualize objects of faith as objects of immanent experience. And likewise, this is in all possibility what Hegel was doing, was he was immanentizing the transcendent and reconceptualizing it as a purely time-bound, purely this-worldly entity. But at any rate, the Weltgeist was supposedly guiding these opposing forces towards these incremental syntheses, and these syntheses would eventually give way to a grand synthesis. Basically, what according to Hegel, what you'd have are two ideational entities, a thesis and an antithesis, and those would conflict with one another, and then they would gradually migrate towards a synthesis. Now, what Karl Marx did, Karl Marx latched a hold of Hegel's dialectical theory. He redirected it towards the socioeconomic realm. Now, being that Marx was strictly an atheist, he removed any theistic gloss to the theory whatsoever, and basically turned it into a methodology, a socio-political methodology. And so what Marx did was, Marx basically, he conceived of history unfolding in a dialectical fashion, and that's from whence we have the theories of the bourgeoisie and the working class basically conflicting with one another and gradually migrating towards this synthesis, which would be the Marxist paradise, stateless socialism. But down throughout history, the Hegelian dialectic has basically been adopted by several oligarchs who essentially look at it as a method of basically bringing about their great synthesis, which in the end is a one world socialist totalitarian system. Now, one of the reasons that the dialectic works the way that it does is because the two ideational entities that are pitted against one another, the polar extremes, that the antithesis and thesis, they on some level are fundamentally the same. They're not dichotomously related because they share certain crucial commonalities. And for instance, communism against fascism. That's one of the most well-known Hegelian dialectics. The commonality between communism and fascism is demonstrable in the etymology of the two systems themselves. Communism is derived from the Latin word communis, which means group. Likewise, fascism was derived from the Italian word fascio, which also means group. And it's herein that you find a key commonality between the two ideational entities, and that commonality is collectivism, the exaltation of the collective and the subordination of the individual to that collective. So it was this commonality basically made the two compatible. And by the way, fascism, yes, fascism did have this ostensible observance of private property rights, but those private property rights were basically susceptible to rigid governmental regulation, and as such, amounted to mere pageantry. So, really, there was really very little difference between fascism and communism. In fact, Adolf Hitler once candidly confessed to I forget the individual. But he confessed in the book Hitler Speaks that the whole...
Hermann Rauschning.
Yes, Hermann Rauschning. He confessed that the whole of National Socialism was based on Marx. So already you see the commonalities of the two ideational entities, and that was what gave way to their eventual migration towards a synthesis. So essentially, that's the background on the Hegelian dialectic. That's how it functions and how it works.
So to be clear, in a sense, the oligarchs believe that they've found perhaps a key to the unfolding of history through this process. And if they have that key, then they are able to direct history in whichever way they want by simply setting up these false opposites and allowing them to combine into the synthesis that they want, the direction that society to travel in.
Yes, although if I may make something clear, they themselves are immersed in the very dialectical climate that they have promulgated. So while they do operate in a Hegelian fashion and are Hegelian activists, they find themselves at times even occupying some of the polar extremes, and in fact gradually migrating themselves towards a synthesis. For instance, you have a Hegelian migration towards syntheses right now between the Western elites, those who were, devoted towards what has been called Pax Americana, and the European elites, those who have been devoted towards a Pax Europa. We're seeing a gradual migration towards a synthesis between the two. Now, initially, that was not the case. The neoconservatives, in particular, their faction of the elite, managed to really alienate a lot of other factions of the elite by basically seizing the crusade for a one-world socialist totalitarian government and transforming it into a unilaterally initiated imperialist crusade with America acting as the spearhead for a one-world socialist totalitarian government. Now the neoconservatives seem to be waning in dominance. I think that the rest of the establishment here in the United States have realized that they're bad for business, and we're seeing more power shifting more towards the neoliberal wing of the establishment, and towards the more traditional elements of the establishment.
However, whichever side of the debate is dominating at any one time, the ultimate direction that the society is going in is going to be largely similar.
Exactly. a lot of folks thought that neoconservatives were opposed to one world government, and to a certain extent they were. However, the neoconservatives were not so much opposed to globalism. They were more so just opposed to the specific schematic that the traditional establishment had in mind. What many of their counterparts, for instance, over in Europe, and the neoliberals here in the United States, had in mind. And such rifts are not uncommon. During the Vietnam War, there were rifts forming in the Council on Foreign Relations, and they became known as the Hawks and the Doves.
And that rift there actually was what caused the creation of the Trilateral Commission, because David Rockefeller approached Henry Kissinger about the crisis within the Council's ranks, and said, basically, what you need to deal with this rift is a brand new group. The elites were finding that the council was less and less of an effective elite machination, and they were also finding at the same time that the United Nations was less effective as an elite combine, because fairly radicalized third world nations and a lot of Eastern Bloc nations were gaining influence in the United Nations at that time. So basically the elites were finding themselves trapped with two very ineffective combines at that time to work with. So Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski began putting together the blueprints for a new elite combine in 72, and in 73 they unveiled it as the Trilateral Commission.
Now, that's an interesting point, and I think it points to the fact that as the political climate changes and as the oligarchs' context changes around them, all they have to do is create new societies, new orders, new groups in which to push forward their agenda on a different level. And I think we see that happening these days with the Trilateral Commission waning in influence as they start to age. What has your guys' research turned up in terms of what new groups might be forming for the political power structures to transfer their ideals and their idea of the scientific dictatorship to?
The Trilaterals are basically lining up behind Barack Obama and are aiming to regain dominance. You can see with the firing of these Air Force generals just a few about a week or so ago and their replacement with Trilateral Commissioners that the Trilats are basically aiming to regain dominance using Obama as a vehicle, and using a possible Obama presidency as a vehicle.
One of, of course, Obama's chief advisor on foreign policy is none other than Zbigniew Brzezinski, who, of course, is a prominent trilateralist.
And what group will come out of that? But what groups will form is anybody's guess at this particular juncture. But what we do know is that it would basically be the remnants of that old Trilateral Commission clique. The reason that Obama is being backed by the Trilateralists, in particular by Zbigniew Brzezinski, is because in Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard, he holds that the United Nations is supposed to play a very important role in the creation of a one world government, and that the American Empire is not supposed to sideline the United Nations. The neoconservatives followed the Brzezinski script to a point, but then they deviated from Brzezinski's script in the Grand Chessboard by sidelining the United Nations, and thus alienating a lot of elite factions overseas, a lot of European factions. If you look back to the 2003 Bilderberg meetings, the Bilderberg meetings are basically meetings of the different elite factions meant to harmonize the different beliefs and opinions and come up with a consensus, and then the different Bilderberg participants then go home and try to make that consensus into policy. But if you look back to the 2003 Bilderberg meeting, there was a lot of hostility between the American delegates and the European delegates. By 2005, everybody was all smiles again, and they were basically working to try to fix the rift. And so that's where we see whatever new elite machinations are going to exist. That's where we see them coming out of, is this group of trilateralists that have lined up behind Barack Obama. Don't expect, though, the neoconservatives to necessarily disappear entirely. You'll recall that they were kind of alienated and snubbed by the Clinton faction of the elite when Clinton and the neoliberals gained dominance back with the 93 election. But the neoconservatives that had been in the Reagan and Bush 1 administrations sequestered themselves in the defense contractors' camp during that period of time and waited for the time where they would gain access to the political system again. And that's very much what could happen this time around. And I think that no matter who is in power, the administration will have to cater to those defense contractors that the neoconservatives are allied closely with, because there are, if you look at Iraq right now, there are more defense contractors there over there than there is military. The contractors thus hold the government here hostage, because if they were to pull out at any time from Iraq, the infrastructure would collapse. And so government and the contractors have become so merged and so interconnected that it would be impossible to pull away from them without causing serious problems to the political structure here at home and abroad.
That's a good point. And I think to a certain extent, the neocons, in resisting the UN-dominated One World Order, in a sense almost build it up by building that false resistance to the One World Order, which causes the public to react against it, against the American unilateralism, that is, and to be more open and accepting to a multilateral solution to one world government. In either case, one ends up with one world government, whether it's American-led or not.
Exactly, and that's a really good point, too. And in a sense, what the neoconservatives have done is they've created a geopolitical situation that would facilitate the restructuring of the United Nations, which has been a goal of several globalist interests for a long time. Back, I believe it was in 2001 or 2002, Boutros-Ghali wrote in an article about how the current world order was basically alienating the United Nations. And Boutros-Ghali postulated that the United Nations would not fold, but that it would essentially undergo a period of extensive restructuring and would emerge as a new, more powerful entity with the ability to more effectively enforce its mandates and its prerogatives. So basically, all that the neocons have done is they've precipitated a climate that would be ideal for that sort of restructuring of the United Nations to proceed.
Absolutely. Let's go back for a moment. Earlier you were talking about Darwin and Darwin's thought, and I wanted to go back and try to connect that in with Hegel and the dialectic. And I wanted to think about how Darwinian evolution could be related to the dialectic and how Hegel's thought may have been an influence on Darwin.
It's very much influential upon Darwin and very much integral to Darwin's theories. Darwin's theory of evolution operates in a dialectical fashion. If you take, for instance, one species, which is the thesis, conflicts with another species, which is the antithesis, gradually those species competition leads to a synthesis, which is a new, more highly evolved species, a new highly evolved race. And basically Darwin's theory of evolution gave credence to Hegel's belief that the human civilization had brutal beginnings, and that brutality, that violence, that war would continually shape it. On a microcosmic level, Darwin's theory of evolution basically depicts life as a struggle for survival amongst competing species. On a macrocosmic level, and Darwin believed this himself, that extends to nations. It extends to tribes, it extends to clans, and it extends to nations. And several later Darwinians even believed that that war was central to the evolutionary process. And Darwin himself believed that the genocide that was taking place in Africa with British imperialism was facilitating evolution. He believed that the colonial warfare that was taking place against the Africans would, in his words, quote-unquote, make the destroyers vary. And so this gives rise to what could be dubbed Darwinian militarism, which is the belief that war is central to the evolutionary process.
War is competition. War leads to biological adaptation. Biological adaptation is progress. Therefore, the way that you bring about progress is through conflict.
Yeah. Now, of course, I mentioned that Hegel's theory of the dialectic was influenced to a certain extent by a Gnostic Kabbalist, Christoph O. Ettinger. There's a continuity of Gnostic thought in Darwinian theory. Basically, Darwinism, according to Dr. Wolfgang Smith, operates as kind of a Gnostic myth, because it basically rejects the transcendent origin of being, and it makes it basically provides the premises for the Gnostic doctrine of self-salvation with the metaphysical claim of self-creation, which is encapsulated in the Darwinian thesis of abiogenesis, which, by the way, was proven completely and totally impossible by Louis Pasteur in the law of biogenesis, because something cannot in and of itself come from nothing. And of course, this has been a major problem for Darwinians throughout the ages. They cannot demonstrate where
life cannot spring from non-life.
Yeah.
And they say that life sprung from amino acids. Now, amino acids are the building blocks of life, but they themselves are not life.
Yeah, and they cannot demonstrate how throughout this developmental process somehow this lifeless matter attained life and then progressed towards sentience. But it's interesting because this was also the premise of a Kabbalistic legend, the Kabbalistic legend of the Golem, which in that legend it presents a man who is created from dead matter, and the overall assertion is that non-living matter and living matter, death and life are intermingled together and are as one. And you see this sort of thinking is advanced today as the Gaian hypothesis, that all things are alive, and it has become it's come to occupy one of the core precepts of radical environmentalism, which has taken on several other thinkers that also comprised Darwin's thought, including Thomas Malthus and his theory of carrying capacity, and to place that in a nutshell, it holds that there's a finite carrying capacity to Earth, and that we just have to occasionally cull the herd, otherwise starvation, war, famine, and environmental degradation is just inevitable. But it's not surprising that Darwin's theory would basically act as a catalyst for all this, because if you look at the people who surrounded Darwin at the time, and this takes us back to the sociology of scientific thought. Darwin's theory was not formulated in a vacuum. As Miguel de Cervantes put it in Don Quixote, "Tell me what the company thou keepest, and I'll tell thee what thou art." And this maxim is affirmed by the company that Darwin kept. He sculpted his theory along the contours of his own Weltanschauung, which was strongly influenced by several questionable ideologues like T.H. Huxley, who was a racist, a Freemason, a fellow of the Masonic Royal Society, a member of an oligarchical dynasty, and one of the individuals responsible for the formation of the Rhodes Roundtable groups. His thinking was also shaped by Erasmus Darwin, who was Charles's grandfather, a Freemason, a member of the Technocratic Lunar Society, and a supporter of the radical Illuminist-bred Jacobins in France. He was also influenced heavily by Harriet Martineau, who was a Comtean sociocrat, a positivist, and an apologist for the corporate interest of the Whigs in Britain, and an advocate of eugenical regimentation. And he was also influenced heavily by Herbert Spencer, a theoretician of the technocratic social sciences and an advocate of Britain's genocidal colonial warfare. But all of these individuals acted as hosts for ideational contagions that were endemic to the ruling class of that time, and they in large measure shaped Darwin's thinking. So I guess you could characterize it as a mimetic transmission belt of sorts. But for those who would like to caricature these concepts, in particular social Darwinism and eugenics and all the horrible things that came out of Darwinian theory, for those who would like to attempt to caricature that as a bowderization, a distortion of Darwin's theories, I would just direct them to a quote from Adrian Desmond and James Moore, both of which are Darwinians. In their book, they wrote, quote, "Social Darwinism is often taken to be something extraneous, an ugly concretion added to the pure Darwinian corpus after the event, tarnishing Darwin's image. But his notebooks make plain that competition, free trade, imperialism, racial extermination, and sexual inequality were written into the equation from the start. Darwinism was always intended to explain human society," unquote. So basically, Darwinism was always meant to be a social theory, not a scientific one, and the type of society that it was designed to explain was the type of society that Darwin saw continually advocated by the dominant socio-political interests of the time, which were purely oligarchical in character. And it also represents a core precept of the present global oligarchical establishment, which Malachy Martin has characterized as, quote, socio-political Darwinians, because they believe that interdependence upon nations, political, economic, social interdependence, which leads, of course, to one world order, is just a natural corollary of man's corresponding political evolution, man is that essentially you have political science being subsumed under Darwinian theory there, and now in addition to biological evolution, there's a corresponding political evolution, and that's giving way to a one-world socialist totalitarian order.
Absolutely. That seems to be one of those scientific theories that's taken allegorically and applied elsewhere, and perhaps applied for political ends. But changing gears, in the ascendancy of the scientific dictatorship, you not only thank Michael Corbin by name, but you called his radio show A Closer Look one of the most important radio talk shows today. What can you tell my listeners about this man, his work, and his recent tragic passing?
Michael basically got in contact with us back in 2002, and it was in relation with the book The Hidden Face of Terrorism, which was the one that that I wrote prior to the ascendancy of the scientific dictatorship. And the whole book's format came out terrible. It came out horrible. The front cover was wrong. The inside format was just looked poor. But Michael was able to look past all that and basically look into the substance and not into the appearance. And he wanted for me to get on his show and basically explain how terrorism was, for the power elite, not a crime and not criminal activity, but a tool of social engineering, which I did, and it led to a friendship that lasted from 2002 right up until the time of his passing. And Michael was one of those researchers out there who was actually looking into aspects of elite criminality that nobody else was. He was looking into satanic subversion in the military. He was looking into the Process Church network. Most people don't even know what the Process Church is. Its connections to Berkowitz, its connections to Manson, how it had been reconstituted in the 21st century, and we had not just a close working relationship with him, but a very, very close friendship with the man. When he passed, we were hoping that his work would be continued on, that this legacy would continue. And at this moment, I have no idea what the Coalition for a Closer Look intends on doing. What we're going to do, however, is put out a chapter in a book that's dedicated to Michael, and which focuses on his research into UFOs.
Yeah, essentially what we're going to be doing, we're going to be writing two chapters in a book that's going to be published by Tom Horn's Anomalous Publishing. But those two essays were going to constitute the core of a book that Michael had wanted to write with us, and it was going to cover the UFO phenomenon and the connections of it to the intelligence community, and how it's being used as an instrument for what members of the Process Church have actually called religious engineering. And Michael, that was another trajectory that Michael had placed us on. Many of Michael's leads that he gave to us turned out being very fruitful leads for investigation and turning into entire articles and also forms a large bulk of the book, The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship. The man's investigative leads were just outstanding. As Indira Singh has put it, he's the linchpin for investigative work. We had hoped that as he had wanted, some of the information that he had collected would eventually be passed down to us. However, his computer with encrypted files on it has not, been. That information has not been made available to the researchers that he had hoped it would be made available to, and it's just that all of it's locked up in the complexities of poor estate planning, because for all of Michael's great qualities, he wasn't one of the most organized guys, and he didn't really do very effective estate planning, and as a result, the stuff that he wanted to be given to other people just hasn't been appropriated in the fashion that he had hoped.
Absolutely, a very sad tale. And in the wake of Mr. Corbyn's passing, what researchers do you see out there today that you see providing the type of analysis which he was capable of? Is there anyone capable of taking up the mantle of his research?
Indira Singh and Bill Kennedy in particular, those two seem to be heading in the trajectory that Michael wanted this research to go, relying on more relevant and more sound research methods and information. There's a lot of so-called researchers out there right now that are just hacks that rely on gossip and hearsay and rumor, and those two really seem to be relying on what is verifiable. We ourselves are trying to continue on with in his vein by referring to primary sources and into sources that can basically be verified as being legitimate.
Yeah.
What we hope with these chapters that we write in this new book is to put forward a contention that Michael had for a long time. Michael, along with Jim Keith, who is now also passed, was one of the very few people out there that appreciated a man-made deception aspect to the UFO phenomenon. Michael had gone up against, for instance, Robert Bigelow of the NIDS group, National Institute for Discovery Sciences, which is a real hotbed for a lot of intelligence operatives, a lot of individuals tied to elitist interest. And Michael was basically trying to get the diary of Air Force Captain Edward J. Repelt, and was trying to get to it before Bigelow could, because Bigelow would basically use it to try to justify this whole idea of aliens, extraterrestrials being behind the UFO phenomena, and then that would lead to all sorts of manipulation, whether you say the aliens are eating us, alien invasion, as a scare tactic, or you use it as kind of a messianic deception that the aliens are coming to save us and coming with all the cures for the ills of this planet. Michael, however, knew that in Ruppelt's work, Ruppelt had talked about a sit down that he had had with a CIA agent right prior to the 52, I believe it was 1952, 53, UFO flap in Washington D.C. And this CIA operative told Ruppelt about that flap and that it was going to occur, and told him that it was coming prior to that flap occurring, which is very strong evidence for a man-made deception being behind the UFO phenomena. So, and Michael wanted that information to get out to people, and wanted that information to get out to the public, and basically show that UFOs might not have an alien face hiding behind them, but instead might be vehicles for cultural deconstruction, religious engineering, and social engineering. And that's what we hope with our research to basically get out there is that contention that Michael wanted so much to basically show to the public.
Well, it's some very exciting and interesting research. When can we look forward to seeing this book?
Well, the final deadline for our essays will be in August. After that, it goes through the whole publication process with Anomalous Publishing, I would say sometime early 2009 is when Tom Horn is looking to release it. Hopefully everything will go according to plan and it'll go smoothly, and there'll be a few, if any, editorial complexities to deal with in the process. Of course, you know, the best laid plans. We had hoped, for instance, with our book, The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, which we first published in 2003, we had hoped that was it, but of course we published an updated, expanded version of it in 2006, which we initially had not intended to write, basically because of all the additional information that Michael Corbin had made available to us. So, you know, it, again, the best laid plans, everything is tentative and nothing is etched in stone. Also, if I may, another individual who would be an excellent source to look forward to, and his work should be available in August 2008, is an individual by the name of Terry Melanson. Of course, he runs the Conspiracy Archive website, where you can find a great deal of our articles, and he's an outstanding researcher. He will be putting out a book entitled Perfectibilis, which, of course, he derives that title from one of the names for the Order of the Illuminati. And his book will be one of the definitive authoritative sources on the Illuminati. He has derived most of his information from primary source documentation that he has exhaustively collected from around the globe. He has come across old French documents, old German documents, terribly hard to find text. He's basically had those documents translated at his own expense. And his book has the sort of primary source documentation that researchers, serious researchers, would just die for. And Terry Melanson's work is invaluable because the Illuminati, of course, being a major topic in conspiratorial research, unfortunately, a lot of hacks out there have concocted myths surrounding the Illuminati. And this book really lays bare what the Illuminati was, what the Illuminati wasn't. And so I would urge everybody to check out Terry Melanson's book, Perfectibilis. It's being released by Trine Day Publishing, Chris Milligan's publishing company, and it should be out in August 2008.
That book will also dispel two re-emerging, very disturbing trends that we find within deep political research and then research of conspiratorial infrastructures and movements, and that is the re-emerging trend of anti-Jewish and anti-Catholic sentiments. There's some researchers out there that have tried to characterize the Illuminist as Jewish. He shows that to be patently false. There's also the even stronger trend, anti-Catholic trend, that's basically personified by individuals such as Greg Zismansky and Eric John Phelps, that somehow the Catholic Church is behind the Illuminati and basically driving this. He shows in this book where that is absolutely untrue, and that, in fact, the Jesuits and the Illuminists were competing with one another. They were competing factions, and Adam Weishaupt had adopted a lot of the means and methods placed down by the Jesuits and used them in his own group, but he was using them to actually destroy the Jesuits. While he hated the Jesuits, he admired a lot of the different methods that they had, and wanted to use them to basically break the Jesuit dominance over the social order at the time.
Sounds like some very interesting research, and I'm sure my listeners are looking forward to the release of that book as well. Paul and Philip, how can people find out more about Paul and Philip Collins and find out about your work?
Well, folks who'd like to check out some of our articles, they can do so by going to Conspiracy Archive, all one word, conspiracyarchive.com/commentary/Collins, C-O-L-L-I-N-S with a capital C, dot P-H-P. Now, that's quite a mouthful. To give you more of an abridged version, you can just go to conspiracyarchive.com, click the commentary link, and then a list of the regular contributors to Conspiracy Archive will come up. Paul and I are right there. You just click that link, and it'll take you directly to a complete, comprehensive listing of our articles. Those who would like a copy of The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, you'll want the 2006 Book Surge edition, the edition that was released through Book Surge, and it is available through Amazon.com. I apologize for the limited availability, but Book Surge is essentially a subsidiary of Amazon.com, and that is why it is offered exclusively, but primarily through Amazon.com. If you have the ISBN code for the book, which is 14196393323, you can take that ISBN code to your local bookstores like Barnes & Noble, Walden's. Give the ISBN code to the bookstore, and they should be able to order it for you. Also, folks who would be interested in contacting us with any questions can do so by emailing us at thefaceunveiled, all one word, thefaceunveiled@yahoo.com. Those who would be interested in joining our Yahoo discussion group can do so by contacting us at that email address. We just want to familiarize all people interested in joining the group with the guidelines. And once they're familiarized with the guidelines and have accepted the terms of participation in the Yahoo group, we'll send them an invitation. But I believe that's just about all of it. And Paul's book, The Hidden Face of Terrorism, is available through all online book retailers, Amazon.com, BarnesandNobles.com, AuthorHouse.com. So all you have to do is just enter it into the search engine, and you should be able to find it.
The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship also elaborates upon what we spoke about today in terms of the dialectic struggle. It really fleshes it out even further, because there's so much more to be said about the topic.
There certainly is. In fact, we've only touched on some of the numerous topics about which you're obviously very conversant, and I hope that we can have you back on in the future to continue this conversation.
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Paul and Philip Collins, for joining me today on the Corbett Report.
Thank you.
Thank you.